Boyer Construction, Inc., and others. Arguing for Bank Mutual is Roy L. Prangy, Attorney Prangy. And then we will, who will argue for 25 minutes, have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and then we'll hear a counsel for the defendant's Boyer. Counsel?
Thank you. May it please the court. This is a case and an unfortunate scenario that plays out frequently in the state of Wisconsin. It's a commercial case, but it's one which affects, I think, all of the citizens of Wisconsin. And it's a situation where we submit that the Court of Appeals decision, the effect of that decision, exacerbates what are already very negative impacts from commercial foreclosures. Unfortunately, foreclosures are a fact of life. Commercial foreclosures happen. I would say that in today's climate, we're all doing our best to try to forestall those, to forbear from doing that. This decision, however, that we're asking this court to review, the decision of the Court of Appeals, really creates a problem in the process. This was a standard scenario. We have a construction company that borrowed money from the bank to develop property and wasn't able to make it. And typically in these situations, the bank will loan money to the corporation. The corporation often consists of husband and wife or brother, father, son, family relationships, family ties, or maybe a partnership, a group of individuals who form a company. Typically in this lending relationship, we have the lender that's the bank, we have the corporate borrower, and then we have the individuals who are the owners of the company guarantee the debt. The bank looks to that guarantee as additional security for the debt. And in addition, it has primary security in the form of the mortgage on the real estate that the funds are being loaned in order to develop. In this climate, it's the same problem in the commercial area as it is in the residential area. Property does not sell at foreclosure sale for the amounts of the debt. And that leaves the bank with making a decision as to what do they do. Do they foreclose on the property and do they reserve a deficiency claim against the borrower? Do they exercise rights against the guarantor separately? And that's exactly what happened here. In many cases, banks will pursue guarantors and they will wait to attempt to obtain a judgment against them until the property is sold and those proceeds are applied against the debt and basically to see if there will be a deficiency.
Can I ask you a question about that? You can sue the guarantor separately and independently of the mortgagee, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
A mortgagor, I should say. You can do that first?
Yes.
Can you go all the way to judgment?
Yes, you can.
So he might get judgment for the $1.5 million that's owed on the note,
right,
on the guarantee for the
yes.
note. Then when you come to execute that, if there's been a foreclosure, you'd have to deduct from the judgment anything you've already gotten. Is that how it works?
Yes, they would be entitled to a credit for whatever the foreclosure.
That's not what happened here, though. What happened here, is that right? It didn't happen that way here.
It happened differently here in that the bank included a separate cause of action. Rather than suing separately on the guarantee, the bank included a separate cause of action on the guarantee itself.
That's why
and obtained a money judgment.
That's why I'm asking that question, because in this foreclosure action against Boyer Construction, the guarantors were parties to the litigation.
That's correct.
The reason I stress that is because the statute in issue here uses the word party.
Yes,
and when I read the statute, I didn't know whether it was loose wording of party, meaning any person who has an interest, or whether it meant, in the strict legal sense of the word, party to a litigation. What does it mean?
I think parties can be used in a number of different
I know. Senses. That's why I'm asking the question. So how do you want it used?
Well, I think in the context of this case, within the context of the statute and what we're asking this court to overturn the Court of Appeals, it does not mean parties to the debt. The issue here, if we get to the statute, 846.103(2), is whether those guarantors are parties to the debt itself, the underlying debt itself. So I would say that Mr. and Mrs. Boyer are parties to the litigation, and that's simply because they've been named in the lawsuit and a claim is being made against them. But in the context of the relief that's being asked of the circuit court against them individually, that's where we get into this issue, are they parties to the debt? Because what happened here was the bank, like most banks, looked at the corporation, Boyer Construction, said they don't have anything. So there's no point in getting a deficiency claim against them. We'll waive, and they expressly in the pleadings, waive the deficiency claim against them, and at the same time, made a separate cause of action. Instead of suing in a separate action, sued in a separate cause of action, which I would contend is the same thing, basically, and obtained the money judgment. And that happens in commercial loans because typically the lender, which has an obligation and has examiners looking at them and has an obligation to the shareholders of the bank to pursue these remedies. It's not a happy situation, but that's the fact of commercial loans. And so what a bank would do is to obtain a money judgment against the guarantors, which is enforceable. It wasn't enforced in this case, that's the judgment sit. And then when the property is eventually sold, that has to be credited and the judgment partially satisfied. Well, in this case then, the bank exercised its right under 846.103(2). And what happens in that particular scenario is the statute says that the bank elects, it's an election by the bank, it elects to shorten the redemption period. In commercial cases, the redemption period is 6 months. You have an opportunity to reduce that to 3 months. The similar statute in the residential foreclosure area is a 12-month redemption that can be reduced to 6 months. But in those contexts, you don't have guarantee issues that come up. The guarantee issues really come up in the commercial.
Can we look at 846.103(2). Let's look at the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because that's the issue. This is a statutory interpretation.
Absolutely. Under sub 2, and the way the statute reads is that if the election is made, the borrower gets to stay in possession of the property and collect all the rents, and the deficiency is waived against, and I think the language verbatim is all those persons personally liable for the debt.
No, it's every party who is personally liable.
Every party personally liable for the debt.
Right, secured by the mortgage.
Yes, Your Honor. And our view has been, and the circuit court agreed with us, that a guarantor is not personally obligated on the debt. A guarantee contract is separate from a note. There are three contracts here. Really. There's a note, which evidences the debt. The debt is the borrower got a loan from the bank. There's the note, which evidences the debt. There's the mortgage on the real estate that's security for the debt. And there's a guarantee. But the guarantee is a completely separate contract. It is one in which we contend that, and I'll talk about this a little bit more, that the guarantor becomes primarily liable to pay under the terms of the contract when the borrower defaults. Now, there are two types of guarantees. There's a guarantee of payment, there's a guarantee of collection. Guarantee of collection, which we don't have here, and which you don't see very often, frankly, a guarantee of collection means you're going to have to go out and sell the real estate first. You're going to have to exhaust your rights against the borrower before you can come against this particular guarantee. Guarantee of payment is different. Guarantee of payment, under the terms of that contract, says if the borrower doesn't pay, you immediately become primarily liable. And I think that the error of the Court of Appeals decision is to equate primary liability under a guarantee with personal liability for the debt. And I think that's wrong. I think that if I have a claim against a guarantor, I can't sue them on the debt. I can't sue them on the note, which is the evidence of the debt, because the guarantor did not sign the note. All I can do is look to the terms of my guarantee and sue on that basis.
You know, what you say makes sense to me. And I understand that what the Boyers did was sign a guarantee. Because they could have, the bank could have said, we want not only the corporation to sign the note, right? But we want you, Mr. and Mrs. Boyer, to sign the note, right?
They could have done
it.
It's not common.
No, but they could have done it. That would have made the Boyers personally liable for that note, right? They could have done that. Instead, they do it as a guarantee. And you're right that the guarantee is a separate contract in which you agree to guarantee, right? And I'll pay, whether or not the other guy pays, I'm going to pay. And you can sue me whether or not you go to the collateral, right? I mean, it's very broad, right? Is there anything the bank can't do?
Under the terms of those guarantees,
nothing. Okay, the bank can do everything. But that's a matter of form. When you really pierce all of these double transactions, the Boyers are personally liable for that debt. The result of all this is they are personally liable for the debt. You got two pieces of paper instead of one, and you may be better off with the guarantee because you may not get as many rights if they had just signed the note, right?
I respectfully disagree.
Okay, you tell me why.
I do not believe that, again, I think there has to be a distinction between the three types of contracts. I could not assert a cause of action against those guarantors by alleging that they are obligated on the debt. They didn't obtain the loan.
That's right.
They don't have any interest in it. They signed a separate contract. I think an analogy might be a letter of credit. A letter of credit is sometimes given to these transactions. And what happens is, again, like a guarantee, that's a separate contract, and the bank that issues a letter of credit is bound to honor that if certain conditions are met and if the letter is drawn upon. But I don't think that makes that lender personally liable for the debt.
Mm-hmm. In the vernacular, it does, or it can. I sign, someone comes to me, and I sign a personal guarantee, right? I'm personally, and what does that mean to me? Gosh, if they don't pay, I'm personally liable. That's what I hear. I'm personally liable if I sign a guarantee. And what am I liable for?
I would submit you're liable for the obligation that you undertook in signing that guarantee.
And what is that obligation?
It's to ultimately pay what's owed to the bank.
Yeah, so I'm personally liable for the debt. Isn't that? So now that's, to me, the vernacular. And it's nice if the vernacular match is plain meaning and matches the words of the statute, but here you're suggesting that personal the words of the statute, which are personally liable for the debt, doesn't mean what I'm saying I would hear in the vernacular.
I'm saying it doesn't reach a guarantor's liability. And I there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that I think it's against the legislative history of the statutes. In the Glover case, they set forth the legislative history in connection with 846-101, which is the residential counterpart, which has the 12-month redemption period, which was reduced to 6. The law was changed in 1959, and when the law was to provide this option to a lender who's foreclosing on residential property, and what the Glover case pointed out was that foreclosure is a complicated, costly, time-consuming process. And is there something we can do here in order to ease that problem? And I think all of what they said with respect to 846-101 applies equally to 846-103, sub 2. And what the court observed was that by providing an election to shorten the redemption period, we're providing the lender with the benefit of not having to wait a whole year in order to sell the collateral while perhaps the property is deteriorating, the taxes are not being paid, and you've got all the problems that are associated with that. So we're going to give a benefit to the lender that's foreclosing. On the other hand, we've got the mortgagor, and the court specifically points to the mortgagor and says, at the same time, the mortgagor gets to stay in possession of the property. If there's any rents or profits that are being generated by the property, they can keep those. In other words, there would be no receiver appointed as a practical matter. And at the end of the day, the mortgagor has the satisfaction of knowing at the end of that 6 month short redemption period, there's no further liability. Well, there's nothing in the legislative history that suggests that 846.103 is intended to benefit guarantors. I think the effect of the decision is to give guarantors a free pass, and none was intended. Chapter 840, I think you have to look at the entire chapter that 846.103 is in. The chapter deals with foreclosure of mortgages. 846.103 and several other provisions deal with redemption rights. It's clear that guarantors do not have redemption rights. So there's really no place, in my view, in 846 for dealing with guarantors. It's a separate contract, and I don't think there's anything in that legislative history that suggests that there was an intent to
could,
do that.
Could I ask, is a corporate mortgagee personally liable?
Yes.
Okay.
So because they, I mean, assuming they signed a note.
So. Mortgagor.
In this case, S.J. Boyer Construction, the corporate mortgagor, would be personally liable on the note. And that's what the bank did. The bank waived its deficiency just against the corporation.
Would the Boyers have been better advised then to sign the mortgage agreement?
To sign the note?
Yes.
I don't think the bank would ever make a loan under those circumstances. The bank gets greater protections from the guarantee because if they had signed the individual note and the bank waived the deficiency, it's gone against them. They would have no further rights. But by signing a guarantee, and that's, as I say, I think that's common lending practice.
The defenses might be different from a guarantor and a signatory.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, I mean, you know, the guarantee that's the subject of this action is a Wisconsin Bankers Association form guarantee, which has evolved over the years. I mean, the language changes as this court issues decision. A primary example that comes to mind is a provision on attorney's fees that this court held in the PCA Laufenberg case that a contractual right to attorney's fees merges into the judgment, so you can't collect post-judgment attorney's fees. Well, that led to changing the language in the form guarantee that says you're contractually agreeing to pay all attorney's fees, whether it's before or after judgment or in any other proceeding.
Mr. Prange, let's assume for a minute that you're wrong on the distinction between personal liability and primary liability. My understanding is you're still saying you should win, and you should win because of waiver. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Would you explain that to me, please?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the second issue, really, is whether the express terms of the guarantee contract can effectively nullify the statute if you were to find that a guarantor is covered by the statute. And we submit that it does. The language in the guarantee is words to the effect that the guarantor waives any right to claim that the bank ought to be pursuing all other collateral before it goes against the guarantor, along with exercising other remedies. The guarantee language also says to the extent not prohibited by law. So the argument, if I were to play devil's advocate to myself, the argument is that, well, 846.103 says you can't go against the guarantor, so that's prohibited already by law. I think that's an incorrect argument. The statute merely gives an election. It does not say you can waive that election. I mean, this court has held that parties can waive contractual rights, constitutional rights, the right to trial by jury, for example. It can waive homestead rights. So it's, again, unless somebody were to say there are public policy grounds for not allowing parties to contractually waive a provision of the statute. But I would submit in this case there is no public policy that would dictate that the rights of a guarantor to enter into and contract waiver rights should somehow be protected. It simply doesn't rise to that level. I started my presentation by indicating that I felt that the Court of Appeals decision exacerbates an already bad situation. I think that under the Glover case, the court said that the cardinal rule of statutory construction is the golden rule, actually, is that unreasonableness of result is enough to reject a statutory interpretation. Here's where I think the problems arise if this decision is allowed to stand. First of all, lenders are never going to waive deficiencies because they don't want to give up their guarantees. So now what do you have? Now you've got a situation where we've got a six-month redemption period in every case. We've got, that doesn't help the borrower at all. Now the borrower's on the hook when the borrower could have been off the hook before. We've got the property that's continuing to deteriorate. We've got interest that's running. We've got taxes that are accruing. Those taxes someday are going to have to be paid, but who's going to pay them? And it really doesn't benefit the guarantor because the in order to protect obtaining a judgment or a deficiency against the guarantor, and you've got more time, you're basically tacking on time, now the interest is running, and the guarantor's exposure is actually increasing over this period of time. I don't think that's in anyone's best interest. The project's deteriorating, real estate taxes. The citizens of the state who would prefer to have the taxes on commercial properties paid in order to lessen the tax burden on them individually is certainly impacted here. So I would say that kind of a result is the type of an absurd result that ought to be rejected and a finding made that waiving a deficiency judgment does not affect guarantees obligation and that waivers of guarantees are enforceable.
Could I summarize your argument by saying that you're not a party personally liable for the debt unless you are a party to the note?
That's correct.
That is your argument.
Yes,
and in the end,
Your Honor, if I may,
pardon me? Go ahead.
If I may, and I think I've cited the section, I can't give it to you.
401, is that the one from the Uniform Code?
Negotiable insurance
right.
Law that nobody is liable on
unless they've insurance. Signed it. Yes, you're sir. Saying that, although it may not be directly applicable
right.
Here, the concept is, in your opinion, directly applicable.
Yes, sir.
What about other states? Do we have a sense of what other states are doing?
I, to be honest with you, I did not look at other states. I think this is strictly an issue of Wisconsin law. And
well,
I can't really speak to our
speakers. Could I ask once more? The mortgagor, I always confuse these things. The mortgagor is that S.J. Boyer Construction Company?
That's correct.
The borrower.
It is both borrower and the mortgage.
All right. And you say it is only the only others beyond the mortgagor would be people who sign the note. Is that right?
There, the other parties in the transaction, using the word parties again in multiple sense, would be S.J. Boyer, who is both the mortgagor and the borrower, and the Boyers individually as guarantors. They did not sign the note. They're not borrowers. They're not mortgagors because they have no
okay, but the people who would be relieved of the deficiency are only those people who sign the note.
That's my contention.
All right. But you told me that the bank would never accept guarantors who signed the note. They wouldn't do that.
I think what I said or intended to say was that in the lending transaction, the bank would ordinarily not accept the individual signing the note rather than signing the guarantee, because the bank gains greater protections under the guarantee. And if the individual signed the note and if they have assets, then the bank essentially cannot exercise its rights to get a short redemption period without risking losing them because they did sign the note. I'm conceding that if they sign the note and the bank waives the redemption, makes the election, then that would release them.
I'm sort of looking at this as someone who knows almost nothing about this, that in order to get the shortened redemption period, the mortgagee is giving up something.
The mortgagee is giving up the ability to collect rents during that 3-month period, which could be substantial. If you have an apartment building, for example, or a shopping center, and those are generating rents, if they elect to the short redemption period, they're giving those up. Sometimes that, they're not willing to do that, and so they will not make the election because they want to start collecting the rents right away, especially if those rents are being dissipated, for example.
And in return...
But it just doesn't seem to me if you're going after these guarantors and can get the full thing, you really aren't giving up that much. You want to go forward quicker. In order to go forward quicker, you give something up. But in the end, you get everything.
Well, you're giving up the ability to assert a claim against the corporation. That may or may not have value. And secondly, you're giving up, as I said, the ability to collect to collect the rents, for example. And I mean, it goes back, I think, to the observation of the court in the Glover case that we're trying to do something to streamline what's otherwise a complicated, costly situation here. And the way to do that is to have these trade-offs. The legislature at least thought that was enough of a balancing factor there. It seems to me if you throw the guarantee in the mix, I don't know what the bank's getting out of, the guarantee's getting a free pass, and the bank is getting nothing for giving that free pass to the guarantor.
Counselor, this case, I think, pulls on people's heartstrings a little bit because the owners of the corporation are the guarantors, and so it's easy to kind of emotionally collapse them all together. But our decision on this case, as well as the Court of Appeals decision, applies if, say you have a large corporation and a guarantor that owns no part of the corporation in the sense we have here, but perhaps as some type of a shareholder where there are hundreds of other shareholders and this guarantor makes a guarantee, the law applies to him as well as this mom and pop corporation, correct?
That's correct, Jar. I mean, it's not unusual where instead of just having the mom and pop corporation, you have a number of sophisticated commercial investors and they're putting their money into these deals all of the time, and I don't think any of them, when they sign that guarantee, expect that they're going to walk when the bank proceeds to elect a deficiency. So it does affect far more deals than just the ones where we've got the mom and pop individual owners.
I want to return to the words of the statute because this case, in large part, is a case of statutory interpretation, and I want to focus on the word party. In question and answer, the word party has been used in varying ways, it seems to me. The statute uses the word party.
And that is, to put it in context for those listening, the statute says that the plaintiff in a foreclosure action may waive judgment for any deficiency which may remain due to the plaintiff after sale of the mortgage premises against every party who is personally liable for the debt secured by the mortgage. What does the word party mean in that statute?
Every party, I think it would mean every party to the transaction.
Why doesn't it mean every party to the foreclosure action? Because the subject is the plaintiff in a foreclosure action may waive. So why aren't we talking about a foreclosure action, a party? I don't know. I'm just asking because that's one definition.
We're in the foreclosure action, and so if I'm trying to decide whether to make that election, and I look at, well, who are the parties here? Parties to the transaction are the corporate borrower and the individual guarantors. And now I look at the statute, and what I would say is I look at that entire phrase, parties who are personally liable for the debt. And so I think that that always has to be the way you look at it, rather than just saying they're clearly a party to the foreclosure action because that's where we are right now. We're in a lawsuit.
That's right. That's why you started out your argument saying, hey, we joined it in the in a separate cause of action, but analytically that's the same as though it were a separate lawsuit.
Well, and I hope what I said before was that now party to the debt is different from party to the transaction.
Okay, and
party to the lawsuit.
Okay, party here means, what does party mean? Party to the transaction, where do you get that?
In the context of determining, again, I don't think you can look at the word party now in the statute without the phrase who is personally liable for the debt.
That defines party. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's true.
Yeah, and the Court of Appeals looked at that phrase and said, hey, just like I did earlier using the term vernacular, the Court of Appeals looked at that phrase and said, hey, a person who personally guarantees a debt is personally liable for the debt, and the Court of Appeals.
Right, and I think they erred by equating primary liability with personal liability.
Well, is a person who guarantees the debt, if I guarantee, God forbid, if I guarantee my daughter's car, buys a car, I guarantee the debt. Okay, if I guarantee the debt, I'm going to say to my daughter, honey, if you don't pay that, I'm personally liable for that debt. So you make sure you pay it.
And I would probably say the same thing, but I think there's a legal distinction here to the words we use in the vernacular.
And that's what part of the fight is right here. I mean, the Court of Appeals said plain meaning, or essentially plain meaning. That's what the words mean, and we're saying, no, there's a technical meaning here.
Well, and I think it's contrary to the legislative history of the statute, as I pointed out.
Do you agree with the Glover case's description of the legislative history? I'm sorry.
Yes, I do.
Do you agree with the Glover's?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Interpretation of legislative history? So in that one, as I remember the Glover case, the legislative history interpretation was that the deficiency would be forgiven only against the borrower, mortgagor.
I think what happened was there were multiple properties, mm-hmm. and they waived the deficiency on the first one. And the defense coming back when they sued the second time was you can't foreclose on any more property. And what the court held is, yes, you can, because that was additional security for the debt. It's just that you can't get any further deficiencies in any of these other proceedings.
There any other questions? Time is up.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please
Mr.
the court.
Gold.
My name is Philip Danen. From the law firm of Rolls, Kytus, Franzi, and Danen, and I represent the mortgagor, which is S.J. Boyer Construction Company. More importantly, I represent Stephen Marcy Boyer, the guarantors in this matter.
Now, both Mr. and Mrs. Boyer are involved in this?
Yes.
Okay.
The personal guarantee was signed as part of property or part of the borrowing against the property of the corporation. At that time, Mr. and Mrs. Boyer were married.
The reason I ask is because at one time they seemed to be on separate paths, but then got on the same path. Is that right?
The reason I explained that they have a divorce,
which led
them to different paths.
Okay.
Something
must have happened. But then here they have the same interest and same counsel. Okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Denon.
May it please the court, my position on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Boyer respectfully disagrees with Mr. Prang's interpretation of both the statute and the clear language of the statute. 846-103, as it is clearly defined in its terms, and I think as Justice Bradley, Justice Prosser have already elicited in some of the questioning that they've gone through with it, makes it clear as to exactly how this process can work. And I think the bank's position in this situation shows that what they're trying to do is have their cake and eat it too, so that they can have
no
giving
law
nothing
against
up.
That, counsel.
There is no law against that, Your Honor. However, in this situation, there is law against being able to get the benefit of waiving a deficiency judgment and then getting everything that you are asking for in a personal guarantee.
Counselor, but they could still get everything they asked for in a personal guarantee, even if they didn't waive the deficiency judgment. It would just take them a little bit longer. They'd wait 6 months, not 3 months.
Absolutely.
And that shortened period, well, what does Boyer Construction do? Do they have any construction equipment?
They do, in fact, have construction equipment.
All right, and they didn't go after that and seek to liquidate that so the folks wouldn't have a business to run, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, so there was a benefit to your client by their not seeking deficiency against Boyer Construction.
Very little.
Well, they didn't sell the equipment of the company, correct?
The equipment of the company, I don't think, would have anywhere clear or anywhere near an amount that would clear even the deficiency as it occurred in this situation.
That's true, but if they had let the matter run for 6 months, which the statute gives them a right to do, they could have sold the equipment, shut down your client's business, and they still could have collected 100% of any deficiency on the guarantee, correct?
Absolutely. Okay. And the absolute difference in this situation and the opposition of our positions with it is the bank would have you believe we need to get that property. We need to have that, and the statute needs to be the most expeditious that we can for a bank to get the property. And I'm here to tell you that that is 180 degrees incorrect. The statute, the purpose of a redemption period, is to give my clients and all of my clients, both the mortgagor and the guarantors who are relying on the mortgagor to pay that mortgage, so that they give them every opportunity to cure and to fix that default.
Right,
they
so
want
they
the entire
out.
Redemption
mm-hmm.
period.
Okay.
The change in the statute came about in 1959 so that commercial property could be redeemed for a shorter amount of time, allowing the banks to have that time. We still have a 12-month redemption period for personal residents.
Unless the lender elects to shorten it and then get 6 months.
And they
cut
would,
it in half, just like this.
And in that circumstance, as they would go, I would submit that under the interpretation given by the bank, they should ask for not only a guarantee, a personal signature on the note from that person individually.
Under the case law, that would be foolish for them to do because then they'd be out from under the guarantee and into the statute.
If it was personal property, if it was a personal residence, you could get a signature on the note, signature on the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you also then get a separate guarantee on every transaction?
You know, Counselor, getting back to this case, because this is a commercial case, it's mm-hmm. not somebody's home that we're talking about. It seems to me if I agree with you and I decide to uphold the Court of Appeals decision and my colleagues go along with that, then there is no reason a bank will ever elect the shortened period.
The bank will always make the election for a shortened period given the circumstances that the statute was intended. They would look at that circumstance and, one, to say, is that property sufficient in value that I believe, making a value-based judgment to say, that property, we will get enough out of it. Close enough. Maybe it won't be everything. Maybe it'll actually even be in
But, you know, the bank
excess.
Has an obligation to their shareholders. If banks don't proceed rationally, they're subject to scrutiny by the inspectors who inspect banks' operations. Banks could fail, and it's certainly in our economy. We've seen a number of banks that have failed because they had poor lending practices.
Absolutely.
So I don't really see how, if I agree with you, that from now on the bank is always going to let that three-month period go. I mean, 3 months is not a lot. You have a deficiency here of over $300,000. So I can't imagine that the bank is going to say, we'll take a chance on this and just let it go.
The absolute reason for that intention is exactly as you state with it. You will make a determination that whether or not we think we're going to get sufficient value out of that property or wait 3 months. Now, remember, 90 days as well is not much. To wait an additional 3 months, this foreclosure sale took place over a year and a half ago.
Sure.
You know, as we're continuing to wait with this situation, 90 days is nothing. But that is the exact purpose of what the guarantors and what the mortgagor is looking for. In a commercial setting, they're looking for another 3 months. In a residential setting, they're looking for another 6 months. That is their opportunity to save their real estate. That is what this is intended to do, so that they have both directions.
Okay.
If the bank gives up that 90 days, mm-hmm. then the homeowner or the guarantor or the any person on that note or any person that is liable for that debt would then have that that trade-off where they would be given that.
So I just can't see why a commercial lender would ever want to use the three-month period. And I really wonder if their board of directors would ever let them use the three-month period. You know, you'd have to be tremendously oversecured with.
Well, and given the banking environment as we're currently going back to, I should say, as it was before, you have very much less risk involved with it, so that there are sufficient collateral assets that you can collect against. And if that is the case, you waive that 90 days, gives that mortgagor a shorter period of time, including to go to those guarantors and say, we need to save our real estate, so that we can save the shop, so that we can save the business by refinancing or finding whatever needs to be done so that the bank does get paid.
Okay, thank you.
Now, the bank has a financial statement from the corporation, right?
Presumably.
And therefore can evaluate whether this corporation has enough assets over and above the value of the land to pay a deficiency, right?
Certainly.
And the bank has real estate appraisers or can have access to them to determine roughly what the appraised value of this real estate was, right?
Correct.
And the bank has financial statements of the guarantors.
Presumably.
One would assuming they're doing it right.
Correct.
And can evaluate the assets that could be reached under the guarantee of the individuals, right?
Correct.
And in 2009, 90 days in a sale period on real estate or stocks, depending on which 90 days, would have made a tremendous difference.
Well, again, we're not discussing stocks.
No, but real estate too. Sharp declines.
There certainly been declines. I would dispute whether or not 90 days has a great effect on the values of these
right.
things.
Or what part of the country we're talking about, what
Certainly.
Part of the state we're talking about. All right. So you've got all of that, and that's the bank, theoretically, is supposed to consider all that in getting a guarantee and in getting deciding whether to proceed in 3 months or in 6 months, right?
Certainly.
And one assumes that they made the decision here that the individuals had the assets and the corporation didn't. And that's why they should go in the manner in which they did go. Now, do you agree that the real issue in this case is whether or not you will interpret the statute as a lay reader might interpret it, in non-technical terms as to personal liability. And that another way of interpreting it is as a person familiar with how banking business is done and guarantees are done might interpret it differently.
Well, I would direct the court, as the appellate court reviewed this matter, the state ex rel Kalal versus Circuit Court, where the statutory language is given its common, ordinary, and accepted meaning.
I know, but in Kalal it says something else that says if the technical words being used, you give it the technical meaning.
Correct. And if there were technical words being used in this statute, which I contend that they are not, they're used in the vernacular as they're expressed.
That's the issue.
Certainly there are certain circumstances along those lines. I would direct the court's attention to the statutory language as it's used twice. As I pointed out in my briefs, it's not just party. It's any party. It's not just any party. It also states every party. I don't think you can have more inclusive language to point out that we're talking about anyone and everyone. We're not talking about the mortgagor. Contrary to what Mr. Prang points out and states that party doesn't mean party to the debt, it means party to the note. They indicate specifically it's party to the debt, personally liable on the debt.
Well, this bothered me too when I read it. But you can the people on the note can be different than the mortgagors.
Certainly.
So here the property was, I'm assuming, titled and owned by the corporation.
Yes.
Right? Therefore, they're the only ones, the corporation is the only one that can mortgage that property.
Correct.
So when they use mortgagor, they mean mortgagor, that is, the title and title per property and the borrower who's signed on that. Or doesn't even have to be the borrower, right?
Correct.
It could be the mortgagor. When they mean party here, they can mean somebody more than the mortgagor, someone who signed the note.
Absolutely.
So the Boyers could have signed the note, and then they would have been a party, not a mortgagor, but a party personally liable for the debt.
Well, except for, as Mr. Prang pointed out, no bank would ever do that because they'll have so much more to put them on a guarantee.
That's right. They got a choice of how to do business.
Well, and keep in mind, again, this process is controlled by the bank.
Mm-hmm.
None of my clients, neither the guarantors nor the mortgagors, have any choice whether or not a deficiency will be waived. That is to the bank. The process that is there to protect them is this statutory scheme that gives a trade-off to both sides. So that, in fact, if there's value and the bank makes this decision to waive it, then they will waive against every party, against any party, and more importantly, as it points out in the second half of that statute, no judgment be separately rendered.
Mr. Danen, let's assume you're right on the statutory language. I'm troubled by the language in the guarantee itself, the language about consent and waiver. How do you handle that? How do you meet that argument?
I find it ironic that, as Mr. Prang and the banks has pointed out, that waiver that my client signed means everything that they say it means. That waiver that they made in the foreclosure doesn't mean what I think it means, what you think it means, what the common vernacular thinks it means. So their waiver doesn't mean anything. Ours has to mean everything. In their waiver, the first line of that language in the waiver says, to the extent allowed by law.
No, to the extent not prohibited by law.
I apologize for the misstatement. To the extent not prohibited by law. And I think there can be no clearer meaning to the extent not prohibited by law, to say that no judgment for deficiency may be ordered nor separately rendered against any party who is personally liable for the debt. I think 846.103, subsection 2, makes it perfectly clear in the vernacular, in the technical, in any sense you want to define this, to say that waiver is prohibited by law, Wisconsin law.
Counsel, do you think that that waiver is so broad that it falls under unconscionability and therefore void?
Absolutely not. I again, would go back to the fact you're pointing out, we're talking about 90 days. And 90 days in this circumstances gives the public policy, which is intended by the entire Chapter 846, which gives a property owner the opportunity to redeem the property. I would go
I
back with that waiver
as
well.
I thought you were going to say that it's so broad that it's unconscionable to say your client waives everything in the world by signing this guarantee.
My client puts most everything at risk by signing a guarantee.
Right.
And again, the waiver that lets my client off the hook is the decision by the bank to waive and feeling the need to have that property within 90 days. 3 months time period to have a sheriff's sale, cutting off my client's knees to be able to go refinance that property and save its real estate. Had they had that additional 3 months, they may have been able to save the real estate. And in a residential circumstance, it would be another 6 months. That's the intent in this statute. Counsel is correct with his cite to the Glover case. The Glover case is as close as we have in the circumstances to this case. I certainly agree with the history on it. The facts of it are very similar. There's a number of different mortgages that were personally guaranteed by the individuals and personally guaranteed by another corporation, of which mixed back and forth in different counties, different real estates with it. The bank in Glover didn't even take the position that we get to go back and get everything we ever may have in a deficiency on the personal guarantees. I think if you look through all of that, everything that it's not explicit, it's certainly implied, and it's certainly discussed, there is no request on behalf of the bank to get everything else in a deficiency. The holding of that case specifically pertains to their ability to go and continue to do foreclosures.
Yeah, but Counselor, wasn't the security sufficient to pay the debt in that case? So just because you have a guarantee, it doesn't mean you have to go after the guarantors. The bank can choose to foreclose on as many mortgages as they have under Glover for this particular debt, which is in default. If they get paid that way, there's no reason why they have to go after the guarantees or seek the guarantees, but they could have done it at the same time if they chose to.
It's absolutely true, but once they waive, and the holding of Glover is very explicit to this point, once you waive a deficiency, you waive a deficiency towards any and every person. And the discussion in the Glover case with it talks about the personal liability of what's left over for that deficiency judgment. That's exactly what we're sitting here with it. In Glover, the bank didn't take that extra position. It's unclear whether or not that additional property would have sufficed, would there be anywhere. But the holding of this court was very clear to say you can continue on with your foreclosures. In fact, in our situation, there were additional foreclosures after this one that have continued on. I believe one of them is possibly pending in a redemption period right now, but as that's being taken care of. We agree and understand the holding of Glover says they can continue all secured debt, all foreclosures or all mortgages can be foreclosed. The issue is what remains after that. And I think the history that was spelled out in Glover, as well as the holding and the implicit holding based on the position taken by that bank, is the deficiency is your personal liability. And that personal liability, however it used to be separately rendered, however it used to be gone first or second with it, is personal liability for the debt secured by the mortgage. Clear, absolute language, directly on point with 846-1032.
If the guarantors pay, I'm going to take it out of this fact situation, if the guarantors are forced to pay under the guarantee, can they go back against the principal obligors? Suppose the corporation was okay, but the bank just decided, hey, guarantors are good, we can get them easily. So the guarantors pay. Can the guarantors go back out after the corporation?
And foreclose on the property?
foreclose. Well, the guarantors don't have any mortgage.
But certainly, but it, to go back against the, if you're asking, can they go back against the company
yes.
and foreclose on the property?
Well, they can go back against the company seeking their money that they paid out.
Okay.
Can they do that?
Certainly, they would have. They'd still have the ability because under the terms of the guarantee, the guarantors understand that there's no obligation to go to take it first, as well as the Kramer case.
Okay.
They can do that, but when they come back and do a foreclosure against the corporation, they cannot waive a deficiency and get the 3-month redemption period.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm getting at. Let's forget the redemption period. Let's forget that. Bank, corporation doesn't pay off on the note. So the bank says, okay, Mr. and Mrs. Boyer, we're going to go out after you. You pay. It's been a default. You pay. Okay? And the Boyers pay up. For any number of reasons, they don't want to litigate this, they pay up. Can the Boyers then seek reimbursement or indemnification from the corporation for having paid the corporation debt?
I think they would have a right of indemnification or contribution, I would think, depending on the circumstances of why they were forced to pay. But that would be a contractual obligation between the corporation and the
doesn't say guarantors. That in the guarantee, though.
The guarantee is not between
right, that's right. So you
the
don't
Boyers
have
and their company.
So where does the indemnification come? The reason I ask the question is because if the guarantors can go back against the corporation in this fact situation, when the corporation has been protected against deficiency, it defeats the statute.
I think
I'm making an argument in your favor in case you don't recognize
it. And I appreciate that. I would agree with that to those circumstances. I don't know if it would occur that way given any of the fact situations.
Well, I don't either.
But I'm sure my clients would be in favor of it.
Except that I did look outside the statutes, and there's an ALR third report on mortgages effect upon obligation of guarantor forbidding of statute forbidding and restricting deficiency judgment. And one of the comments they make is that that's might be an indirect effect, which would undercut the statute. I haven't seen that argument made here, and I don't know if it's in a good argument. I'm just telling you what.
I think the circumstances of that argument are extremely remote, although possible, and certainly I recall at least looking through that ALR article with it on the fact, but the circumstances. At least as it relates to this case, and I don't think very likely to occur with that because in a circumstance like this, corporations typically don't have any ability. In my client's circumstances with it, the corporation is solely owned by Mr. and Mrs. Boyer, and so that pocket goes from one to the other. And
could I?
We're not piercing the veil here.
No.
Could I ask if the Boyers prevail in this case, what will be the impact on commercial lending in Wisconsin?
I think, quite frankly, it'll have very little impact outside of the addition, the requirement that the bank make a better value judgment to determine whether or not to waive a deficiency or have to wait 6 months. The legislature has already made that determination 50, 60 years ago with it when it decided commercial property is different. It should go from 12 months to 6 months so that it is quicker in commercial property. 6 months, as we're all aware, can go by in a heartbeat with it, especially in business as it's going this way. If there's a problem that something needs to be protected, if there are rents that the potential of having rents come into your pocket for this 6 months with it, the court or the bank, again, in charge of that process, can apply for a receiver to be appointed, collect the rents, and apply them should the property not be redeemed. The bank and the bank's position takes the effect of saying they have no intent of letting you save your property. And that is 100% the intent of the statutory scheme on both residential and commercial.
You suggest that this statute has been in place for 60 years?
The statute from 1959 is when they switched to the six-month redemption for commercial property.
Well, the statutory scheme has been in place for a long time. It strikes me that this fact situation is not particularly novel.
If you review the transcript from the trial court, his exact words were, "You'd think there would be a case on this."
Right. Well,
which I guess is why we're here.
Okay, suppose there is no case on this. There has to be some evidence out there of what has actually happened for the last 50 years.
Well, and I think if you look at the statute or the case law that has occurred, the closest we have is Glover, which is very similar to that fact situation. But looking at those circumstances, it's my contention that very seldom will a bank actually try to get the 3 months and still have the nerve to come back and say, we're also going to get everything we gave up. They wait the additional 3 months. The flip side of that, and the reason why we don't have that much as far as evidence and circumstance along those lines, is very seldom does a person in the position of my clients get before people such as yourself to be able to make this type of argument. They obviously, you know, did not have the circumstances to be able to pay their mortgage. They've had the problem that went through everything with it. Typically, you do not have the opportunity to continue and make this argument. The vast majority of foreclosures end in default, and that's the end of it. The property is sold. They realize they've lost everything. We stand before you here today and ask you to clarify so that we show that the purpose of the statute is to allow a person a right to redeem their commercial or residential real estate so that the bank has that. And if the bank makes its choice to shorten your ability to redeem the property, then it gives up the ability to come after you later. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Prangy?
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Prangy, is there a right of subrogation of the guarantor against the signer of the notes?
It would be contribution, right?
Contribution? Okay, so there's a way back, right?
Yes, there is.
How do you answer the argument that defeats the statute? That defeats the statute if the guarantor can get a deficiency against the corporation.
I guess I wouldn't phrase it in terms of a guarantor getting a deficiency against the corporation. It's that the guarantor is being called upon now to honor the guarantee. Mm-hmm. Whatever it pays, at least under equitable contribution principles, enables it to go back against the person who should have paid the debt.
Right. Who is protected by the statute against a deficiency.
I don't think it protects them from the waiver of the deficiency.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Mr. Bannon suggested that really no bank has had the nerve to do this before.
To seek
the redemption period and then go after the guarantors for everything.
I think that happens in the commercial world frequently. Banks will evaluate their collateral position and who's responsible.
Speak into the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think that happens in the commercial world frequently. The banks will evaluate their collateral position and where they can best make recovery as quickly as reasonably possible. And that's why a lot of these cases, Glover, for example, and the other cases, all have arisen, I think, as I mentioned earlier, where they just didn't go after the guarantors directly. They just went after them for a deficiency when it was all done. But I think commercial lenders have realized that if the guarantors have assets, and again, it may be, you know, we've got to look beyond just the mom and pop guarantors here. If there are other investors that have assets, then the bank would be well advised to try to get a judgment against those assets or at least a lien against those assets as quickly as possible. And that was one of the things in this case. We obtained a money judgment against the guarantors at the same time we got the foreclosure judgment. So there's all the talk has been in terms of the deficiency. The deficiency doesn't even come into existence until the real estate is sold. We had a viable, collectible, enforceable money judgment to deal with and could proceed on that. The bank did not do that, but it had the right to do that. I would just point out as well, we have another case in my judgment besides the Glover case the Bank of Sun Prairie Marshall Development case, which was a Court of Appeals case. Similar idea. In this case, there were a couple of different corporate entities involved. There was a corporate borrower, an individual guarantor, and another corporate entity that pledged a completely separate piece of real estate. And the bank originally took a judgment against Central States, was the corporate borrower, against Central States and the individual by the name of Ludlow, who had guaranteed it, and obtained deficiency judgments against both of them. Again, that was a situation where they didn't commence a separate action on the guarantee. When the bank then went against the second corporate mortgagor, which pledged separate property, the Central States and Ludlow objected, saying, "Well, you've already got your deficiency in that. You can't go against that additional collateral anymore. You've got to go against what you have left now." And the court disagreed and said in the decision, which was based on Glover, said that clearly this separate, as I mentioned in my argument regarding the legislative history protecting the mortgagor of the property, the court said this guarantor over here and this separate first mortgagor, let's say Central States, have no interest in this real estate over here. They are not the people that were intended to come within the benefit of the statute. This separate corporate entity is the one that's entitled to the benefit of the statute and the redemption rights. Counsel had indicated that the purpose of the redemption period is to give the guarantors the opportunity to redeem. Again, I have to go back to my argument that guarantors do not have redemption rights. That's not part of the deal. If the guarantors had pledged real estate and they were mortgagors, then they would have those rights.
I don't know if you said the purpose is to give the guarantors the right to redeem. You said the purpose of the statute is to give a chance to redeem.
I think I heard him say a chance for his clients, which would include to redeem the property, which would include, as a practical matter, if the guarantors were able to come up with the money, they would simply pay off the bank and the bank would assign their position. And that's how it would go through. One last comment. Mr. Dana had indicated, or I understood his argument to be, well, if you hold in favor of the Boyers and all the banks have to wait an additional 3 months in order to foreclose, no big deal. But I think we have to remember that there are big deals and there are little deals. There's all kinds of commercial. This is about commercial transactions in general. I don't think the amount of the deal should dictate it. You can have a huge commercial development that where rents and profits are accruing, but interest is accruing on multi-million dollar loans. And in those situations, 3 months can be more than just a heartbeat.
Mr. Prangy, the red card is up. Those of you who are familiar with the court know we have a lighting system of green, go, orange, 5 minutes. Red.
I was waiting for the buttons up here.
I know, and so was I, but I got signaled that the red light is on theoretically. So I want to thank you for your argument and thank Mr. Dunham for his argument on a very interesting and difficult case involving a foreclosure. And of course, you know, this is the county that has piloted the program on mediation and mortgage foreclosure. So that concludes our argument in 08-AP-912, Bank Mutual versus S.J. Boyer Construction, Inc. The court is in recess.